2 here on the Phoenix Suns podcast here on SB Nation Arizona in our collaboration with Bright Side of the Sun. Chris Habas, as before, is only the second edition, so I can't say as always. And Jim Kochenour, we have him on the line as well, as we did last week, talking Suns. Some pretty positive feedback on the first podcast there, Jim. How are you doing tonight?
I am doing good. Obviously, last week it seemed like you did a little better job with your predictions for the Suns than I did.
Yeah, I don't want to be Nostradamus when I pick them to go 0-4, and there was two games in there they should have won potentially, and one game in there that they could have won when we talk Memphis. But yeah, and an 0-4 week is an 0-4 week, and a 0-7 skid is an 0-7 skid. I mean, it's pretty bleak times right now. They've lost 8 out of 9 and 7 overall, 4 games last week. And let's kind of recap the week real quick, where we started off Tuesday, ending the road trip at Memphis. They ended up losing the game in overtime, but pretty much owning that game for about 44 to 45 minutes of that game. What was your overall thoughts on that game?
That was another situation with the recurring theme we've seen to see this season, where the Suns will play the better part of the game and seem impassioned. They'll play three quarters good. They'll play 36, 40 minutes well. And then they just have, you know, this period where they're kind of languid and lackluster. I don't know if it's, you know, mental lapses, but there are these lacunas in play, in the good play, and those cause them to just get waylaid and are their complete undoing. And that's what we saw in that game where, you know, even in that game, actually, it was 48 minutes for the most part that they played pretty well. As soon as the buzzer sounds in overtime, the Suns just don't take the court and Memphis wins.
Yeah, and it's tough in that regard because you look at it, and to flash forward into the Dallas game, they were playing well, and then another guy, Zach Randolph, dominates overtime and takes care of the Suns, and then you have O.J. Mayo in the very next game in Dallas take over and take out the Suns. Kind of an unfortunate underlying issue for the Suns that they don't have a go-to guy, and they got to do this all by committee, and they get beat in back-to-back games by what the NBA is about, having a star guy that you can go to down the stretch. And it's tough to see that happen to you. It makes you realize what you don't have.
Yeah, after the Memphis game, I made a comment on Brightside that Zach Randolph just had a better game against the Suns than any Sun is capable of having this season. We're not going to witness an individual performance by a member of the Phoenix Suns, you know, this season. To see a performance like that, it's going to have to be a player on an opposing team. And then the next game, we get a chance to see O.J. Mayo, who's having an all-star caliber season so far. If he continues on his trajectory, I expect him to make the all-star team as a reserve. And that's a player that the Suns had looked at this past summer. And he's scoring the ball well and at a very efficient rate, you know, a rate that he probably can't keep up. But the Suns' absolute lack of an even above-average scorer is very disconcerting. You know, going into next week now, it's 14 straight games that the Suns, they didn't have the high scorer in the game. The high scorer in the game was from the opposing team.
Yeah, and in some cases, the top two or three high scorers from the other team ended up being in the game where the Suns are. And that's kind of where they're at, unfortunately. They're sitting as a team that collectively the best effort they're going to get out of most guys is in that 16 to 18 range, and out of their best players in that 22 to 25 range. I think we talked about this last week where the top scorer on the season is 26 out of Goran Dragic. And, you know, to go into the next game, this is a nice little progression here, to go into the Clipper game, Michael Beasley, house on fire. Holy heck, where did this come from? 18 points, 5 rebounds, 4 assists, 3 threes in the first half. Amazingly efficient performance. Went out there and played really good in his first bench game to turn around and lay an egg in the second half. Part of that is the team's biggest issue, which on offense in terms of their biggest issue, which is getting the ball to the hot hand when the hand is hot. They went away from Beasley. He took one shot, I believe, that he made in the entire second half, which was his 4-3 of the game, and then after that he was just dead silent. That's a huge issue for this team, is they don't, if you have 18 at the half, you shouldn't finish with 21 for the game, basically, and that's what Beasley finished with in the Clipper loss.
Yeah, you know, looking back at that, I kind of felt, you know, using Gentry's hot hand philosophy as a point, a focal point, I was kind of surprised that he didn't start Beasley in the second half, because we've seen him bench players in the fourth quarter and keep riding guys that had come in as reserves. And, you know, we've seen it with Marcin Gortat, for instance. And so that was a perfect example of where he could have kept Beasley in the game, or maybe even brought him back earlier in the third quarter and tried to, you know, keep feeding off of the momentum he developed earlier in the game. And he didn't. And Beasley, after the great first half, was, you know, basically a ghost. When he was out there in the second half, he didn't get engaged, re-engaged in the game. And, you know, it just turned into like a complete imbroglio, just a grease fire in the fourth quarter. And, you know, going back on that again, it's where the Suns just, you know, I don't know if it's the effort or what, but it just disappears for a stretch and the game's over.
Yeah, and then you turn to the Magic game, and I think Beasley checked in at about the remaining in the first quarter, the 1-115 mark. I mean, he came in with under 2 minutes to go in the first quarter, and it's got to be disconcerting as a player. I'm not going to put all this on Beasley, because you're right, the disengagement was clearly there in the second half of the Clipper game, but the fact that Beasley doesn't come in until the under 2 minute mark basically of the first quarter after the way he played in the previous game in the first half, I mean, it's almost like they use the analogy in football all the time with Matt Leinart that he's really good when he knows he has no competition. And it's a thing with Beasley where I think he's really good when you give him that confidence, when you may not necessarily coddle him, but you let him know, hey, you're our guy and we're going to go out there and throw you out there and let you play. And you can't check a guy. And the minutes are inconsistent. Like you said, riding the hot hand, sometimes the starters will stay out there for 4 minutes before a sub, and then other times 10 minutes before a sub. And in the second half, Beasley took forever to get into the game after having an amazing first half. There's inconsistency, but it's always been like that with Gentry, and you'd like to see him maybe ride the hot hand a little bit better. The way he does it in the fourth quarter sometimes kills the team to where they don't have energy at the end of the game. And then in this situation with Beasley, it's you got to ride him in that game with Scola in the Magic game. I don't know what happened in the second half. Same scenario, 8 points in the second quarter, 4 or 5 shooting, really was the team's offense in the second quarter. And then he again, another guy with 3 points in the second half and has borderline nothing going on in the second half. And even his mind was blown that the ball didn't really go through him in the second half in that Magic game when they were just getting abused in the fourth quarter. It's just an underlying theme of this team. They have trouble getting the ball to who needs to score when they're in with the position to score. It's been tough. And that's how you have an 0-4 week, is you give up one to Memphis, you give up one to Dallas, you completely forget to play basketball in the second half against the Clippers, and then you come into the Magic game on a 6-game slide, and you can't handle a team that is one of the worst 4 or 5 teams in the league at this point right now.
Yeah, I've heard a couple players kind of suggest that are hinting at that the inconsistency in the rotations and the minutes has affected them in some way. There are some players that are a lot more malleable, that are more adaptable, that can deal with pretty much any situation that's presented to them, so they can adjust into the different roles. But I think that other athletes like to have more structure, more of a defined role, know coming into the game kind of what to expect. And so I think some of these guys have sort of struggled with that. Now, that Magic game, it didn't help, obviously, that Dragic was out of the game. You'd like to think that he could have done better than 1 of 7 from the field, like Telfair did. Nothing against Telfair. I love his tenacity on defense off the bench, but he's not a starting caliber quality point guard in the league. Nobody really had a great game in that game. Like you said, not being able to get the ball to the people in the right positions. Gortat and O'Neal combined for 10 of 16 from the field. They scored 21 points, had 11 rebounds in the 48 minutes from the center spot. It seems like they were able to score effectively, but then you'd like to see them take some more shots than that. You know, the two of them had 16 combined. They made 10. Brown takes 16 by himself. He makes 6. So, you know, that game at home against the Magic, I mean, it's not the kind of performance that gives you a lot of optimism moving forward.
Yeah, and we kind of, in the press conference before Gentry came out there after the loss, I was sitting there with a Valley of the Suns guy, Michael Schwartz. We're sitting there talking, And he kind of had the assessment of, it's pretty tough when you have the best two players out there on your team not playing. And then you sit back and you think about it, then you go, Goran Dragic, yeah, I agree, that's the best player on the team. And P.J. Tucker didn't suit up that game, and he's a guy who makes the least amount of money probably on the entire roster and played in the D-League in Europe over the past 2 to 3 years. That's the second best player on your team, and it's not a knock on P.J. Tucker. It's a knock on the fact that he's outplaying guys that were expected to come in and play well, and that's part of the reason they lost to Orlando. I mean, they weren't just missing Goran, they were missing P.J. Tucker, and in a sense, they were missing their best two guys. They were missing their LeBron and Wade. And that's kind of that's the reason why they're in at the position they're at. It's kind of their season in a nutshell. Their go-to guys, their best two players, are a small forward off the bench that provides energy and a point guard that just plays just all out relentlessly for 94 feet. And just neither of those guys are superstars. Neither of those guys are put them on the back of your shoulders and carry a team to a win kind of players. And those are your best two guys. When you're missing them, you lose 98-90 to the Orlando Magic.
Yeah, unfortunately, our best two players are kind of the homeless living under the bridge version of LeBron James and Dwayne Wade. But, yeah, absolutely, P.J. Tucker has brought a lot more consistent effort than a lot of these guys that were brought into this team that were supposed to play major roles that have been here. You know, he works hard. He definitely works hard. Guys like Marcin Gortat, There have been times, definitely, that I've watched this year where I absolutely don't feel that he's working hard, that he's giving maximum effort. And I heard Dudley talking about that on the radio a little bit earlier today, and obviously he wasn't wanting to call out other professional athletes on effort and say they've quit, but it really appears to me that guys on this team have quit, at least for stretches during the season. It's hard for me to justify that they haven't, you know, for periods of time.
Yeah, and I completely agree on that. And along those lines, like you said with Jared on the radio, I want to run through a couple of quick news and notes things before we jump into a fun segment we're going to have with hopefully the audience doesn't hate this fun little segment we're going to have. But some news and notes that have been floating around. I was at practice yesterday, and this rumor, maybe I left practice too early. I mean, I was there for an extra 45 minutes on top of what I usually am talking to Lon Babby, but you know, the rumor floating around that Beasley is this toxic, you know, force on the team that's kind of eroding the team from within is a report that not only did I think was kind of preposterous, but was just a silly thing for people to say. I mean, the word toxic was used out of context there. You know, Dave King on Brightside called that out in a nice little Twitter rant. But Beasley was in and out of practice. You know, he was in and out of the film room. I don't know how much he played actually on the court. The team was without P.J. Tucker. They left him out so that way he could be ready for the Wednesday game due to his injury to his leg. Alvin Gentry described Goran Dragic, who missed practice as well yesterday, as white as a ghost, as white as his shoes. Took in two IVs before practice and still couldn't go, so they sent him home. He practiced today, though, kind of lightly, which is good. P.J. practiced a little bit lightly today, which is good. So they're as close to full force as they're going to get. But what are your thoughts on not only the toxic comment, but also the other news that came out that Robert Sarver gave the kiss of death slash endorsement to Alvin Gentry, saying the man who has a contract till the end of the season is safe till the end of the season. I thought not only is that silly, but it was unnecessary. What are your thoughts on those two?
You know, the toxic comments, Beasley, as far as I know, as far as I'm aware, has never been described as some kind of locker room cancer. Somebody that is bringing the team down from that aspect. So I don't know where, you know, his source came from or you know, where he got that from. The team made an investment in Beasley, and whether you question whose directions they're following, the Suns aren't going to just give up on a guy 20 games into the first year of a three-year contract. The front office isn't going to want to admit that they made that big of a mistake. You know, if they did, kind of like the Turkoglu thing from a couple years past, then you'd want to get the guy off the roster. You don't want a guy, you know, a mistake you've made to continue on. I don't know how easy it would be to move Beasley if they wanted to, and I don't think that they want to at this point. They still want to give that a little bit more time, so I don't think there's any credence to that. Obviously, they're probably a little bit frustrated. I think everybody on the team's frustrated, and they'd like to get a more consistent effort from Beasley and more consistent results and better results, but I don't buy into that suggestion. With Gentry, I don't know why Sarver felt the need to, like you said, give him the kiss of death, the vote of confidence. I don't see, I think we discussed this before, how it would be productive to fire Gentry. I don't think there's, you know, a bunch of quality NBA head coaches that are just sitting by the phone waiting for Sarver to call, waiting for Babby to call if they did fire Gentry. So to me, that doesn't solve anything. That's a situation that is better left to address at the end of the season, and I don't know why Sarver felt the need to address that at this point.
Yeah, and it, like you said, it's just unproductive. It just, it makes no sense. And I mean, if you're, I'm sure people listening to this are Cardinals fans. So if you're the Arizona Cardinals owner, Bidwell, and you come out and you say Ken Wisenhunt is safe, then that can draw some ire, because there's actually some productivity in firing a coach that's having a terrible season and seeing what your coordinator has. The Suns don't have that coordinator. They don't have that Brian Shaw. It's not a knock on Marley or Gillespie or Turner or even some of the player development guys. Those guys are all, I'm sure, quality coaches and good basketball minds. They wouldn't be in their position if they weren't. But again, how productive is it to fire Gentry and say, all right, Turner, you got the ropes. You know, you couldn't get the job in Orlando where you were a finalist, or rather Portland where you were a finalist. We're going to go ahead and give you the ropes here. Or here you go, Dan. You know, I know some teams have talked to you and you've had some interviews. Let's see what you got for three quarters of a season. It makes no sense. And with the Beasley toxic stuff, look, fans are from the outside in. You know, media gets to see it from the inside. The guy is as nice as they come. I mean, does he space off? Is he disengaged? Does he, you know, lose focus out there sometimes? Yeah, and that's frustrating to fans because you're not getting 30 out of a guy that you wanted to get you 30 every now and then. But you've been around him. I've been around him. He's absolutely the opposite of a cancer. I mean, he's kind of like that cuddly teddy bear, and, you know, sometimes it's comical because he gets disengaged, but in no way, shape, or form would I see him as any kind of a toxic personality. And if we're going to go toxic, I'm going to name names, and I'm sorry for doing this, but the only toxic personality the team might have on here is Marcin Gortat, with the things that he says in the media, with the things he says privately, and sometimes the way he carries himself. But he's a character, and he says what's on his mind, and he's from Europe. Sometimes those guys don't get it when they say these things, but he's been around long enough to know that. If anyone's a toxic personality, it's those comments that he makes in the media, but I don't think the Suns have any toxic personality.
Yeah, Gortat hasn't necessarily comported himself as diplomatic professionally as you, diplomatically, professionally as you'd like him to. You know, he stepped back off of some of his comments recently. He seemed to kind of, you know, become more measured with what he was saying, because at first he came out and kind of made some stuff public, and now he seems a little bit more reserved with it. I still don't think he's happy. And, you know, I really believe that a conversation between him and the front office has probably already taken place, and Gortat's not happy being a Son right now. But, you know, that's up to them to go from there, and that's just me speculating and nothing that I know for sure, for certain. And, you know, like you said, Beasley is, he's like a goofy type of aloof, a little bit quirky. There was an article about all the crazy stuff he had in his old house before he came here, and he's a little bit weird, but yeah, I agree with you. I don't see him having that, you know, caustic type of effect on the locker room.
Yeah, and I would like to meet that guy's source, because it's just silly, in my opinion. It's someone talking to a reporter to be able to get something out there, or it's some guy just speculating and making stuff up because he sees a guy on the bench looking disengaged. I mean, that's I can only come up with those two kind of a things, because Beasley's not that personality. Now, Quit, I don't want to talk about this too much, but if I were to ask you, and just a quick one-sentence answer out of you, what do you think is the difference between this year and last year with Michael Beasley? Is he having a better year so far through 22 games than he did this year versus last year? What would you say?
I would say close to the same.
So, yeah, I'll just cut you off there, because, like I said, I don't want to go over this too much, but, I mean, his point differential, he's minus 1.23 points this year, minus 1.65 rebounds. That's really the most alarming thing. He's up almost an assist and a half a game. He's got 54 assists at this point versus 24 last year. And his shooting numbers are pretty similar. I mean, from From the two, he's shooting 41. From the three, he's shooting 30. And from the field goals overall, 38. None of those are good percentages. But last year, he shot 42 across the board from field goal, from two, and from three. He's pretty consistent. So it's jarring that people are, his plus minus is terrible. That's because he plays minutes on a worse team than he was last year. But when you look at it, through 22 games, he started 7 last year. He started 20 this year. And he's off by fractions of a percentage or a whole percentage on every single category across the board statistically. He's just playing on a worse team with a worse record with a terrible plus minus because of those two factors. So, yeah, does Beasley deserve some flack, and does the front office deserve some criticism so far? Yeah, but we're 22 games into a 3-year contract, and I think people are just being a little bit too in the moment with the way they're describing Beasley, and it bugs me a little bit. Go back and actually look at the numbers and look at the play. This team is not as good as Minnesota was last year, and I just think that needs to be known, that through 22 games, he's almost the same exact player as last year. He's just shooting a little bit down, and his plus-minus is horrible because the team is not playing well.
Yeah, both of the last 2 years with him, it seems like there was a regression from some of his previous numbers. The thing that I was kind of expecting out of Beasley that I haven't seen is more of that 18-point first half performance. I figured that maybe every 5, 6, 7 games that we'd get a night out of Beasley where he was around 30 points, where he kind of got hot and was able to ride that momentum through the game. And then I figured we'd have some games like we have where he wasn't able to get into the flow of the game and wasn't much of a factor. So I expected some of these, 5-point performances. I think, like you said, he had a 3-point performance last week. And I expected up and down. It just seems like there's been a little bit more down. A couple of years ago, I know, with Minnesota in a more expanded role, he scored about 20 points a game and was a little bit more efficient from the field. And it's nice to see him kind of get back to that, at least, or to figure out what the Suns want him to be, what kind of player they want him to progress towards, and kind of move forward at some point this season.
Yeah, and I just want to touch on that a little bit, because I think that just the people are just very, very, very over the top right now with their just sensationalism of how bad, and he's having a bad season. He'll be the first one to admit it. But I think we need to calm down. It's 22 games into, what would it be, total, a 246-game contract. So I think we should probably just give it some time. This is not a good team. And there's opportunity for a lot of players to step up and become that best player. And with this upcoming week, they get to stay home on Wednesday, which is when this podcast is going to go up. On Wednesday at 7 o'clock locally, they get a rematch against Memphis, and hopefully fully equipped with Goran and P.J. Tucker. And Friday, they stay at home. They get the Utah Jazz, and again, another 7 o'clock tip. So 2 games to close out the week versus 4 games last week, so a little bit more rest, a little bit more practice, staying at home, which is good. How do you view this week going?
Let's see, Memphis, I picked them to lose in a bloodbath last time, and the Suns actually came out and surprised me, and they should have won that game. But I really think that, Memphis is going to come in here wanting to prove that was just a coincidence, that wasn't indicative of their talent level, and I think that the Suns are going to get shellacked this time. I have a hard time thinking we can duplicate our previous effort. The Utah game, I think, is a winnable game. Unfortunately, Utah seems like they kind of expose our lack of an inside presence. We make them look like a juggernaut inside, but Utah is only 4-9 on the road, so I think that you have to at least give the Suns a coin flip chance, if not maybe a little bit better. They're playing at home. And then, we actually have one more game before we're going to talk again, and that is against Sacramento. And Sacramento is 1-7 on the road. They're a very bad road team, just like I guess the Suns are. And if we lose to them, I think we will hit a new depth of despair as a fan base at that point.
Yeah, I'm gonna agree with you on Memphis. They're just a better all-around team. Best team in the league, in my opinion, right now. They don't have the record to prove it because they played less games than a few other guys, but win-loss percentage, et cetera, they're one of the better teams in the league. That one should be a comfortable 10-plus point win for Memphis, even though the Suns are pretty scrappy. Utah, you're right. They expose us. And the thing with Utah is it reminds me of the Dallas game. You said the same. I think you had the same analysis to the Dallas game outside of them exposing the interior, is that it's a winnable game and very parallel teams, very similar teams. I think Utah and Dallas, that's a very similar matchup. And Utah just plays the Suns well. And they end up beating us because they can throw the ball down to Al Jefferson and we can't throw the ball right now to anybody. I'm going to unfortunately take Utah in that game. Sorry, Suns fans. I'm giving you guys 9 losses in a row. And I say the skid ends in Sacramento. If it doesn't, oh boy, if they don't win in Sacramento, then there are no changes to fix this team. At that point, it'll just be shuffling chairs on a sinking ship if they decide to make interior changes and kind of moving around the lineup. I think it's a 1-2 before we talk next. You're right. I previewed the week, not the week until we talk next. So I got them going 1-2, kind of the same thing. You have them going 2-1, it sounds like. So again, I'm the eternal pessimist. I got them going 1-2, and you got them going 2-1, it sounds like. Before we jump off, any parting shots for everybody?
You know, I hope that the Suns can go 2-1 this week. I hope they can stop the bleeding a little bit. Fans in Arizona, you got football and basketball, and the ineptitude of our franchises have become, it seems like, a national cynosure, and we're just the subject of derisive mockery by the national media. And I don't see hope for the Cardinals, so I'd at least like to see the Suns come out, show some pride, and play a little bit better this week. They've lost some close games where they just haven't been able to seal the deal, and hopefully they can come out this week and give us a good showing.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. Well, make sure you check out Jim on Bright Side of the Sun. Very, very good site. Arguably the best Suns website out there. I don't think there's a better Suns exclusive website out there than Bright Side of the Sun with what you and Dave and Seth and those guys do. I'm out there on SB Nation Arizona. Check out, if you didn't see it already, I strongly encourage you not to pimp out my own work, but check out the practice report from Tuesday, or rather Monday. A lot of stuff on there, a lot of content, a lot of, you know, insight that was going on with the team from practice. And that's it. That's a wrap. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Peace out. We'll